Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. It's estimated that as many as 12 million Americans suffer from food allergies. Most of the offenders come from a small group of foods, and that includes eggs, milk, nuts, and wheat. The symptoms can be mild, they can be severe, including difficulty breathing and loss of consciousness, and in fact, in rare cases, an attack can be fatal. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about food allergies, a little bit about how they're detected and treated. And our guest for the program is a leading authority in this area. His name is Dr. Wesley Birx. He's professor and chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at the Duke University Medical Center. He's interested in asthma, in food allergy, and other childhood allergic diseases. He's joining us this morning from Duke, and we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us. We'll ask some basic questions here, but of course, as always, the idea is people who are listening should take the opportunity to call in and ask the expert. Questions are certainly welcome. Whenever we have physicians on the program, one of the things that I try to remind listeners is that, obviously, we can't do diagnosis over the phone because the doctor can't see you, but this is a good place to start. Get some basic information, ask questions. I know the doctor will do his best to answer your questions, and then, of course, you may want to pursue this with a physician that you can talk with, but I say that, and I don't want to discourage anybody from calling. Questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, is 333-9455. Now, we do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, so if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or over the internet in the United States, you can use that number, and that's 800-222-9455, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Dr. Birx, hello.
David, it's nice to speak with you today.
Well, we really appreciate you once again giving us some of your time. Just to start, the numbers here are certainly significant, and it would appear that the numbers of people with food allergies, the numbers growing, at least it's something that we're more aware of, certainly, and in fact, and there was just an article today, luckily enough, happened to pick up the Chicago Tribune, and there was an article about how food manufacturers are actually starting to pay much more attention to this and put labeling information on the package and put out products for people who have allergies or for people who have celiac disease. And one of the things in this article that was really striking is that it says that the number of children with peanut allergies has doubled in the past decade. So that all invites the question, are the numbers of people with food allergies increasing?
So it's a really good question. I think there the two parts of it. The public perception certainly for food allergy is higher now than it was 15 or 20 years ago. But even taking that out of the equation and looking at really good studies that were done both in the U.S. and Western Europe, there are cross-sectional type studies that look at populations, particularly in children less than school age, mm-hmm. that the prevalence of food allergy has increased significantly. And specifically, the peanut allergy really has doubled in a little bit over the last decade. The reasons for that, people have thought and wrote a lot about it and tried to understand it better. There are things related probably to the hygiene hypothesis that we could talk about may play a part in it. Things related to food processing that may play a part in it, but ultimately we really don't know why it's doubled in the last decade.
So it is the case, it's not just that we are more aware, and it certainly seems that we are more aware, but also the incidence of food allergies does also seems to be going up.
Particularly in young children.
Okay. And I suppose that one of the questions that parents have who are struggling with this is how likely is it that this is a childhood issue? And will my child grow out of it, or is this something that he or she would be dealing with throughout their life?
Now, again, a really good question and something that we deal with in the clinic every day. The likelihood of a food allergy for an individual child, how long it will stay, really depends on the food that they're allergic to. Mm-hmm. So, for example, children with egg and milk allergy for wheat and soy and other meats and vegetables, those food allergies, if they're there early, are likely to be outgrown in the first few years of life, many of them by school age, but most all of them by adolescence. Not all, but most of them. Mm-hmm. If the child is allergic to peanuts or other tree nuts like walnuts or pecans or others like that, to fish, to the shellfish, then those food allergies typically are not outgrown for the life of that child. Mm. Most of the time it's not outgrown.
And just to make sure that, and I have a caller here, I promise, I'm not going to make this person wait too much longer. There may, in fact, be some people who do not tolerate some foods well, but there is a difference between that and a true food allergy. How would you describe the symptoms, the reaction to something that makes that truly a food allergy and not just an issue of lack of tolerance for a particular food?
Okay, so the best example would be to talk about children and some adults that have adverse reactions after they ingest milk. Mm-hmm. For some of those individuals, they could be lactose intolerant, meaning there's a specific enzyme that they have a relative lack of. And when they take larger quantities of milk, they have gastrointestinal symptoms that happen for the first few hours after ingestion. So they may feel bloated, they may have gas, they may have a little bit of diarrhea, and it doesn't go away over time. And then there are children that have immune-mediated reactions that really is what the term allergy is. And it is reproducible within a few months, but as we talked about earlier, it may go away in a few years. And the symptoms, the way you can tell is that for lactose intolerance, the symptoms are just related to the gastrointestinal tract. Mm-hmm. But for milk allergy, the immune-mediated one, they'll have symptoms related to the gastrointestinal tract, plus the skin, plus maybe even the respiratory tract. So it's multiple systems involved, and it almost always happens seconds to minutes later. It may be up to a couple of hours later, and so that's reproducible. And so those things help in your history taking to find out whether it's likely to be immune-mediated or not immune-mediated.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Wesley Burks. He is chief professor and chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at the Duke University Medical Center. And we're talking about food allergies, particularly those that we see in childhood. But I'm sure that if you have other questions, that doctor would do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller in Champaign to start with. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to just mention this and call in. I had very severe allergies as a child, and I was reading a couple articles about parents, and I sort of wanted to offer some advice as the child who had very severe allergies. I'm now in my 50s. I had an allergy to everything but lamb, green beans, goat's milk, apples, bananas, and rice from the time I was about a year old till I was five. About five, they started being able to introduce food slowly. And my parents did a great job. It upset my mother, but she never let me sit around and say, oh, you poor honey, you have this allergy. It was just a matter of when people offered me cookies, I said, no, I can't have that, but I can have an apple. No, I can't eat that, but I can have a banana. And I was never allowed to feel like it was poor me. I still to this day have, there are foods I can't eat. There are foods I have intolerances to as opposed to allergies. So going out to eat can be a real interesting thing. But I just want to say you can come out and be okay, and there are a lot worse things in the world to have than bad allergies.
Okay, well.
I just wanted to say that because I know some parents are like, I've read articles and they're very worried about the long-term effect, but I went to birthday parties and ate popsicles, and that was my treat. And my parents just kept certain things for treats, and, you know, I was allergic, and I couldn't eat it, period, end of sentence. And I've turned out okay. But I did nurse my children who don't have as many allergies as I do. I want to say that I think that helped.
All right. Very good. Well, I appreciate the story. I don't know, Dr. Burks, you can react to that however you might like.
No, I mean, I appreciate her life story. I think one of the things that we try to talk about with families now is to have a healthy respect of the food allergy, which I think is what her parents conveyed to her as she grew up, and to recognize that your child is allergic and how you might avoid causing them to have a reaction, but at the same time not let that control your life and that just be part of how they grow up. So each child has different things that they have to deal with, and it sounds like her family did that quite well.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Others are certainly welcome to call. If you have a question, you'd like to share a story, 333-9455. That's here for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. How likely is it that if you have allergies, your children would have them? Is this something that has follow some kind of genetic track or not?
Definitely there's a genetic predisposition to having allergic disease. It's not really food allergy to food allergy. So mm-hmm. if you're one of your parents or both of your parents or a parent and a sibling has allergic disease, the new child is more likely to have one of the allergic diseases, which may be asthma, may be allergic rhinitis, could be eczema, or could be food allergy. If one of them has it, it almost doubles the chance of the child having it. If two people in the family have it, it's about a 65% to 70% increased chance of the child or the offspring having one of the allergic diseases.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier. I asked the question. We talked about the fact that it seems that the people numbers of people with allergies are growing. The number is growing, and I asked the question why. And you said that there are people are certainly looking at this. Maybe no one has the exact answer yet. But one of the things that you said there was some interest in something called the hygiene hypothesis, which I think is an interesting notion that has to do with concerns that maybe we've actually made our environment too clean?
Yes, that's true. And there are some good medical studies from Eastern Europe that have come out in the last 25 years that suggest for individuals, for children that grow up in a certain type of farming environment, they have far fewer allergic diseases during childhood and even during adulthood. And they've taken that and translated that information to looking at the more industrialized Western lifestyle and suggest that our lack of exposure to certain viruses and bacteria and even endotoxin in the environment contribute to our immune system now being free to develop reactions to the other things around us, which are going to be the allergens. So there are really good studies that suggest it. I think it's probably overly simplistic to suggest that the hygiene hypothesis would explain the rise, say, in peanut allergy in the last 15 years, because I don't know that we're necessarily that much more clean now than we were 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other issues related to development of the disease relate to not only the genes of the child, but just the environmental interaction. So when they actually first eat a food in life can play a part in the likely development of disease. And then the third factor is just the processing that goes in prior to when we eat the food. And certainly, if you look at different regions of the world that have different prevalence of peanut allergy, the processing of peanuts before we actually eat it is quite different.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to go back to the thing that you just said about how the fact that the age at which you are when you first eat a food might make a difference, does that argue for either trying to introduce more a variety of foods earlier or the other way around? Does it matter? Is that something that's unique to each individual and so you couldn't give that as a kind of a prescription to somebody?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and again, something that in the clinic families ask about literally daily. There are really two schools of thought that you outlined, and there are really good investigators that would suggest that one or the other one are true. The current dogma is that if you have a child that is born into an allergic family, that it may be better to avoid some of the highly allergenic foods like peanuts or tree nuts or fish or shellfish for the first 3 years of life. And so that's what's currently practiced in the U.S. There are some investigators now that are doing studies that suggest that what you said earlier is that it may be better if we give it to them early. And so they're doing studies like that to find out if that really works. I don't think there's probably going to be a lot of individual variation, but more likely if you have the allergic genes based on your family history, this is probably what you ought to do. And it may be introduce it earlier. It may be wait till later, at 3 or 4 years of life. Mm. I think the difficulty is now we really don't know. The medical term that we're talking about has been studied extensively in animals, and it's called oral tolerance. And that's what happens when we normally, as humans, we eat a food and we don't have a reaction to it. We have to develop tolerance to it. And that food that we eat probably doesn't look a lot different than a virus or a bacteria, but our immune response to a virus or bacteria tries to get rid of that into a food. We have to accept it, so we become naturally tolerant. And so why that breaks down in children that are allergic, again, we don't understand. And two, how we can use what we understand about oral tolerance in animals to develop better schemes for humans. That's being studied a lot now, but we don't know the right answers yet.
Just for a moment, going back to the hygiene hypothesis, if, in fact, that part of what's going on is that previously, the way people lived and the way some people live now is that they are exposed to more things. They may be exposed to more viruses, to more bacteria. Generally, their environment is just not as clean. And if that actually seems to have some beneficial effect on the immune system, or at least we don't have the kinds of reactions to foods that we have been talking about, is there any practical way, any practical sort of clinical way, because we can't send people to live on farms for their first few years, and we wouldn't tell people in their homes, you don't have to be quite so clean and diligent about keeping things nice. Is there any way that you could that understanding could be applied clinically so that there might actually be some potential benefit there, some way that you could use that?
Yeah. I think right now the current thought might be that it's an interesting phenomenon, but how to translate that into something practical that we could do, I don't think anybody's really been able to do that. If you go back to and read the studies that are done in Eastern Europe, then these are families that grew up with the livestock, the cows, the barn and the kitchen literally were attached to each other, so that it's all like literally they're almost cows in the kitchen. And that exposes them not only to the animals but to the endotoxin, which is a part of a bacterial cell wall that the cows bring in. And so that's kind of thought to be able to contribute to their lack of allergic disease. So we can't replicate that in the U.S. That's not really feasible to try to do. And short of that, then I don't think anybody's developed something practically that would make use of that information to say if you do A, B, and C, then you're likely to have less allergic disease. I think that's where people would like to go with their research and with their recommendations, but it's not been done yet.
This morning in this hour, Focus 580, we're talking about food allergies, particularly as experienced by children and how parents can deal with those. Questions are certainly welcome. Our guest is Dr. Wesley Burks. He is professor and chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at the Duke University Medical Center. And in his clinical practice, he's interested in a number of things, including asthma and food allergy and other childhood allergic diseases. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have another caller here in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yes, I heard you just now say this was mainly directed toward children, so that's not what I had to ask.
Well,
about.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a friend who, for a number of years, had intermittent diarrhea, and it had started after she'd been on a vacation in Mexico. So she assumed it was a parasite, but they tested for everything that they could think of, and nothing turned up. And she suffered on and off with this for, as I say, several years. And it seemed clear it had to do with the food she was eating. And she tried various things, but it never showed enough regularity that she could pin down what to do and what not to do. And then she discovered on the Internet a long article about something called lectins. And the article said that that these are in certain foods, and that if you avoid those foods, that you will avoid problems. And so she made a list of the foods and carefully regulated her diet, and sure enough, the whole thing went away. Except once in a while, it would come back. And when she would check into it, she would discover that there was something that she didn't know about that was in something she had eaten that was on the forbidden list. So that was sort of a strong confirmation of that she had in fact identified the problem. And my question to you is, how does all this fit into allergies and intolerances and so forth?
Okay, so it's a really good question. the question about what happens on the ingestion of foods that have lectins is something that's being studied, and some people will write about it, and as your friend saw the article on the internet, there haven't been really good studies yet that have taken individuals like your friend and treated them with a diet and then didn't do any intervention to see what would happen with their symptoms over time. So it's an area of research, but not something that for most people practically we can understand what to do with. I think the symptoms of intermittent diarrhea are caused by so many different types of things.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time it's not food related, either allergy or a type of intolerance. Most of the time there are other reasons for it.
Mm-hmm.
And only when you exclude all those other reasons would you really begin to think about foods maybe causing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting area, and again, one that's being looked at in a research setting right now.
Are there any estimates of what the incidence of this might be in the population?
Yeah, there really aren't yet, because there haven't been good population studies.
I see. Okay. Just one last thing I'll mention for the sake of anybody who's listening. This was something that was onset late in her adult life, and what she now thinks is that when she was in Mexico, she was in a situation for several days where she had beans three times a day, and they're full of lectins, and apparently the overload somehow shifted a switch in her body somehow that made her then sensitive to the whole thing. So that's all I had to say.
All right.
Okay.
Well,
thank you for your call.
Thank you. Other questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, talking here specifically about parents and kids, are there things that parents should be on the lookout for that would indicate that that's what's going on is some kind of food allergy? Because it seems to me that you hear stories about parents who have children who obviously are not doing well. And the parents have a difficult time trying to determine what really is going on. And then when they finally do realize that this is a food allergy problem, it's like a revelation. It's like somebody turned the lights on and suddenly things are really clear. And when parents start to modify their child's diet, sometimes they can see really dramatic results simply by excluding particular things from the diet. How do you go about determining that, in fact, if you have a child, you have a young child, that you do have true allergies to foods?
Okay. So, again, a good question. I think a couple of things might happen. One, for children that have food allergy, they're more likely to have an allergic skin rash early in life called atopic dermatitis or eczema. Mm-hmm. And those children that have that rash have a really high prevalence of having the likelihood of developing a food allergy to the foods that we talked about earlier. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is that the symptoms of food allergy are generally confined to three organ systems, to the skin, the gastrointestinal tract, and the respiratory tract. And the symptoms are most of the time relatively straightforward. The skin symptoms are hives or that urticarial red itchy rash. The gastrointestinal symptoms are vomiting, pretty severe abdominal pain or diarrhea, and then the respiratory symptoms that are most concerning are going to be swelling of the throat, severe coughing, and then wheezing. So as you think about the symptoms your child is having, or your physician may ask you, as you talk to them about it, they'll ask about those types of symptoms and the temporal relationship of those symptoms to food ingestion, and they always occur within 2 hours. Generally, that's just uncommon to go beyond that. But most of them occur literally within seconds to minutes after the ingestion. So a really common history that we might see in the clinic is a child who's a year and a half, who's in daycare, and the attendants at daycare gave the child a peanut butter cracker, and the child took a bite of that cracker, and literally before they even took the second bite, their lips would swell, they'd have a red rash around the rest of their face, and about 10 minutes later they would have vomiting and get rid of the peanut that they ate. So all that happened within one bite. It happened really closely to the time of ingestion. So, and the symptoms were, again, the skin and the GI tract, the typical symptoms that you would expect.
Hmm. So it can be immediate enough and dramatic enough so that you would at least suspect that that was what was going on.
Yes. I think that the difficulty in the first case I talked about of the children that have atopic neuritis, it can be a fairly extensive, really itchy, chronic rash. And so if they eat something that causes them to scratch more or have the rash, then it may be a little bit more difficult to notice because they already have a significant rash. But it's something that you may ask about as a physician sees that particular patient in the clinic, the types of symptoms that they're having.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be the case with some kind of allergies, at least with, for example, with seasonal allergies, that you have a pretty good idea what it is and you know when it's going to be a problem. And I think some doctors might say that knowing very specifically what the allergen is doesn't really do much for you, particularly if you know that you can take out your calendar and you can pretty much say, okay, about this time I think I'm going to start to experience symptoms. I know what it's going to be like, and then they're going to go on and they're going to persist, and then when the frost comes, they're going to go away almost overnight. Now, that knowing in that case what it is that you're allergic to, maybe that it doesn't make very much difference. In this particular case, do you think it's worth, or when is it worth doing testing so that you can, in a very specific way, say, yes, here it is, this is the thing, or it is these several things off of this list that are the problem?
Right. I think the first case, that it really is helpful to find out more specifically, because the avoidance really is the main treatment. Unlike the symptoms of allergic rhinitis that you discussed, if you are allergic to ragweed and the Chicago area, then you recognize when it's going to happen, when it's going to go away. Hmm. Even staying indoors, you can't really avoid it. So avoidance isn't practical. But if you're allergic to milk, then although difficult, it still is a practical way to help you not experience the symptoms. So the first case would be the children that have the eczema or atopic dermatitis, and it's moderate to significant in nature, and they've treated it for several months. Early in life, meaning the first year and a half to 2 years of life, there is a pretty good likelihood that that child is experiencing one of the food allergies, and it would be helpful to have those tests done to try to identify which foods that you might be allergic to. So that's one scenario. The second would be that a child that has an ingestion of a food, say multiple foods at one time in a meal, and have those symptoms that we talked about earlier, the skin, the gastrointestinal, the respiratory tract symptoms, then to try to figure out within the meal that they had which one of the foods they're likely to have the allergic reaction to would be helpful. Rather than just avoiding all of them, then you can, with the test, find out the likelihood it's one over the other and only avoid that specific one.
Well, there one thing that that sometimes people do is that they, if they're concerned about some number of foods, for example, as a way of testing, establish a kind of a baseline diet, give their kids stuff that they know is going to be fine, it's not going to cause any problems, and then selectively introduce one new thing to see what the reaction might be. Now, in some cases, maybe that might not be safe to do if we're talking about a really severe reaction, but that is to do that kind of experiment yourself as a parent, is that okay?
I think the normal feeding practices for the U.S. that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends is, and I want to come back to this in just a second, for breastfeeding for a period of time, no solid foods for a period of time. But after that, as they start to eat solids, that the introduction of certain vegetables and then fruits, then meats, if you follow that algorithm, which is basically what you're suggesting, the introduction of a new food over a period of time every several days, then that's extremely helpful, and the chances of them having a reaction are quite small. I think if you did that, though, with the more highly likely allergenic foods, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish, even milk and eggs, that you run the risk of having a reaction if your child is in that allergic type group. So for a family to say at age 2.5, then their child's had other food allergies, to say, well, we haven't given them new food in a while, we want to try shellfish, then that could be a problem. They could have reactions.
So that is, if you already know that your child has some sensitivity to some of these other things, then you could almost assume that, or at least it would be safe to assume that, yes, then they might also be sensitive to something like peanuts, for example. And that would be really,
yes.
That's something you probably don't want to mess around with, just saying, well, let's see what happens if you've already had some experience with some other foods.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the other questions that practitioners see on a daily basis is what to do for a family that has already an allergic child, or either mother or mother and dad both have allergic disease. What do you do for the child to try to prevent allergy or any type of allergy? So that question is a frequent one in the clinics. And I think one of the things to understand is that what we know about trying to prevent allergic disease is to prevent any of the allergic diseases, asthma, allergic rhinitis, a food allergy, not just to try to prevent food allergy. So the current American Academy of Pediatric recommendations, there are two main things that they say. One is that breastfeeding for greater than 4 to 6 months will be most helpful to try to prevent any allergic disease. So, and once you get beyond 4 to 6 months, there's not necessarily added value in from a prevention standpoint to go 8 versus 12. So just greater than 4 to 6 months. And then to not introduce solid foods into the child's diet for that same 4 to 6 months. When both of those are done, in really good studies, it prevents asthma, allergic rhinitis, food allergy from developing. So that's what we would typically recommend for most families now.
Mm. We are a little bit past our midpoint here, and I would just like to once again introduce our guest, Dr. Wesley Birx. He is professor and chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at Duke University Medical Center. We're talking about food allergies, particularly as they show up in children and what parents can do about that. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you could certainly give us a call. Is it very difficult to do parents find it tough when they are trying to negotiate the food landscape? Maybe not so much what they are preparing at home, but if they're dealing with having their kids have food at school, at somebody else's house, eating out, any kind of prepared food. I'm sure that what happens is that parents find themselves having to become very close label readers to try to figure out what's in foods, and I'm not even sure that always works.
So, no, it is a huge issue that families that are already diagnosed that having food allergy for that particular child have to go through an educational process to try to help the family understand what food they're allergic to and the likelihood of where that food might be in the child's environment as far as from a dietary standpoint, and then understand how to take care of the child both at, say, daycare and school. So as we kind of walk through each of those issues, I think the what we talked about earlier and the first caller discussed her family, I think having a healthy respect of the allergy. If your child is allergic to peanuts, then the educational process of understanding the likelihood of places that they would contact peanut in the environment. So foods that sometimes have peanuts in them, say chili is homemade. Some people put peanut butter in that as a filler. If you go to an Asian restaurant, that peanut butter may be used as the sealer on an egg roll before it's fried, and so they would understand that. So that's part of the educational process. The other thing that we do is to give them information about national groups like the Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network that help them in an educational way on their websites to understand where foods are and where they're likely to be contaminated. So that family that has a child with peanut allergy, then they have to make decisions about going out to eat. Again, places that are going to be pretty high risk for them would be an Asian restaurant, an ice cream parlor where they have different types of nuts or peanuts in their ice cream, and they use the same dipper for different foods. That's part of the process for them to understand. And then the school and the daycare, the educational process, helping them understand how the reaction might happen if their child is exposed to peanut in the environment or tree nut or whatever it might be. And I think the biggest thing here is that for families to understand that it really takes ingestion, although of really, really small amounts, to cause most of the severe reactions. So a child can be in the same room and maybe smell the food, or maybe it might even accidentally touch them on the skin. But most of those reactions like that are relatively self-limited. And it really does take ingestion, eating although maybe a small amount of the food, to have a significant life-threatening reaction. And for the families to understand that, and then the daycare and the school to understand that, those are really big deals for them.
Yeah.
So I think the educational process for the family and then the other caregivers, whether it be daycare or school, is an ongoing process for most of them.
Yeah. I'm sure that people have heard a lot of scary stories about that makes it almost sound as if all you have to do is be in the same room with some peanuts. They've heard about the fact, whether this is true or not, that airlines stopped giving out peanuts the way they always used to because they were concerned about the possibility of nut allergies. And one would get the idea that you didn't have to eat it if the person who was sitting next to you was eating peanuts, that somehow you could have a reaction. And I don't know if that's a kind of an overreaction, or that some people can be perhaps not quite that sensitive, but that it wouldn't take very much for them to have a reaction.
Right. I think that the airline story is truly different than the other things in the environment because of the recirculated air on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So a child at school or a child at a baseball park or a restaurant, they don't really see the allergen in the environment the same way that you would on an airline. So, and what happens on an airline is that you have recirculated air, and if a large number of people were to open up peanuts on an airplane, then the protein actually gets in the environment in a significant amount, much different than it would, say, at school. And there are instances where people have had significant allergic reactions. Most of the time, if your child's peanut allergic, they wouldn't react. But the difficulty is that you can't tell in that one child whether they're one that would react or they wouldn't react if they were exposed to peanuts on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So you try to work with the families in the airline to ensure that they have a flight that doesn't have it on it. If it does happen, the likelihood of reaction, though, is pretty small.
Now, the other story that I expect people have heard was this, and I think this was this last year, where there was a teenage girl that actually died after having kissed her boyfriend after he ate something that had peanuts in it.
Yes, and I think as people understood better about what happened in that particular story, that it wasn't necessarily the kiss with peanut butter that really caused a life-ending reaction, that there are some other circumstances involved that were more likely involved in that.
Mm.
So it's not something that I think families would necessarily need to be afraid of, that that's going to would cause a life-ending reaction.
Well, how do you educate parents to deal with an emergency situation that might occur if indeed it did occur?
Part of that educational process that we talked about earlier is to recognize where the high-risk places are to eat, where foods are likely to be contaminated with the food that your child is allergic to, and also to recognize the symptoms that would happen with an accidental ingestion. And those symptoms typically are fairly similar to what happened on the first time they were exposed to the food when they had their initial reaction, related back to the skin symptoms, the gastrointestinal symptoms, or the respiratory symptoms. And so talking about that for each family each year, there's about a 15 or 20% chance that you really will have an accidental reaction despite your best efforts. And so to let them know that, you know, they're doing a good job, but at the same time, this could easily happen. And if it happens, then here are the types of medications that you can use. The two main ones are antihistamines, like Benadryl, and then the epinephrine-containing compounds. And those are different ones that are marketed that have epinephrine in them that the family can inject into the child if they're having a severe reaction.
It seems that now for physicians, you can't do much beyond, well, first of all, counseling parents to understand what's going on and identify that thing that's causing the reaction. And then what you have to do is do everything you possibly can to avoid that. Either, you know, you don't eat it intentionally. You want to make sure that you don't get it by accident. So staying away from those things seems to be the number one response. Looking ahead to the future, do you think that there is the possibility that sometime in the future you would have something more to offer than just having to say to parents, well, here's the thing, your child is allergic to this thing or these things, and what you need to do is everything you can to make sure that your child does not come into contact with those things that are going to cause the reaction.
So I really do think in the next 5 years that there'll be different types of the initial treatment available to do just what you suggest, that right now we have avoidance, good education, and by the way, you'll probably have a reaction here, your medications.
Mm-hmm.
And there are studies going on worldwide to try to come up with specific types of therapy for those children that have food allergy that likely will be long-lasting, which would be peanuts, the tree nuts, the fish, the shellfish. And so there are, you know, four or five major types of investigation that are going on that I think really will come to fruition to have the first generation of treatment so that your child, you know, if they're allergic to peanuts, here's what we might do in a proactive way to treat them rather than just offering them avoidance and then medication in case they have an accidental reaction. And the studies are really promising. They're going on in different parts of the world. And the early reports suggest that there really can be something done relatively soon.
You know, given, I'm curious, you know, we have talked about the fact that we're really not sure what's going on here and why it is that we seem that the number of people who have food allergies seems to be on the increase. You just wonder with something like nuts, for example, since they've been around for a long time and human beings have been eating them for a long time, why it should be now that particularly recently the incidence of allergies to nuts seems to have really gone up very significantly.
Again, going back to the question that we talked about earlier and related to the development of the different allergic diseases and the hygiene hypothesis, the things that you just discussed are all true. And how do you make sense out of that with the good studies that suggest there really is an increase? Certainly other things in the environment, the processing of those foods prior to when we eat them. And so like an example would be in Southeast Asia, then many of the way that children first see peanuts are in a boiled, chopped up kind of mush that the children eat relatively early in life.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that children in the West, Western Europe, the U.S., Australia, see the food is as a peanut butter or a protein that's been dry roasted, heated at pretty high heat, but not broken up and not changed in its protein content at all. And the likelihood of peanut allergy in Southeast Asia is really, really small. And here it's much greater. So that's just one circumstantial evidence that some of the processing that we do prior to when we eat the food may play a part in us developing the disease.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Urbana, line number one.
Hi. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. As a person who's waited 60 years for the world to catch up to my peanut allergy, I have a few tips for parents or new diagnosis. And that is, first of all, if you find yourself, let's say, in an airplane and you don't have your Benadryl or whatever, and you know if you have the very severe kind of peanut allergy immediately because you feel the crawling in your throat and your lips swell, an antidote is to get a piece of white bread or white rice or something of that nature, chew on it, and it absorbs the oil out of your membranes and then spit it out. I found that to be helpful when I've been confronted with it when I hadn't known it.
Hmm.
And it's kind of a, you know, homegrown remedy, but in the absence of anything else, it's pretty effective because you just want to get the oil out of the contact with your membranes, either internally or externally. So that's one survival tip that I could offer. And secondly, I've learned however many times I ask that you can never anticipate the amazing places where you'll find peanut oil. So one of our local movie theaters now pops corn in peanut oil, and if you go into, let's say, a bakery and buy a cookie, it's likely or possible, has been for me, that those products are made with combination oils that are a variety of two or three oils, one of which may be peanut. And the moral of the tale is, if you have a child or if you are in that anaphylactic type peanut allergy thing that you just can't you just better not assume that anything you buy out there in the greater world might not have peanut oil in it, because the likelihood is, you know, fairly, well, possible that it might. And the other thing I wanted to say or ask, since this seems to be increasing over the years, what about the factor of the increased additives, not only in our foods, but in the soils and animals and such, if that might be contributing to this increase? So that's it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
So the latter question about the other additives in foods and how they may play a part in stimulating the more likelihood of disease, people are looking at right now. There's not really so far good medical evidence to suggest that it does play a part, but people are trying to study that to understand it better. So I think it's a really good question. I think one other thing I might comment on related to the last caller is that the whole area of the oil and of that particular plant, whether it's sunflower oil or peanut oil or soy oil or whatever it might be, that what we have our human immune reaction to is to the protein in the plant. So the peanut protein is what causes our reaction. And if you take normally heat-processed peanut oil, which is what many manufacturers may use, all of the protein is taken out of that. And so individuals that ingest heat-processed peanut oil should not have a reaction because there's no protein there. If you take a cold-pressed oil, which you might see at a natural food store, then that protein, the oil has been extruded and protein leaches into the oil, and it really can cause a reaction. I think an example might be that if you go to an Asian restaurant and you have a wok that has peanut oil in it, if you're the first person that eats out of that wok with the peanut oil and you're peanut allergic and the food that they put into the wok has no peanut protein in it, you wouldn't have a reaction. But if the second meal prepared in that same wok has protein in it, they clean the wok out, and then the third and the fourth dish, the peanut oil is still used that they use for the second dish. That now has peanut protein in it from that food, not from the oil itself, and you can't have a reaction. So a product labeled peanut oil, you often have to avoid, but recognizing that if it doesn't have the protein in it, it will not cause a reaction.
Hmm. It certainly seems extremely complicated here for people who are trying to make their way through the world and trying to eat and trying to feed their families if they have issues with nuts. There are also people who have problems with wheat. It's sort of my understanding that more and more manufacturers are paying attention to the fact that there's a significant market here, that there are people who have these problems who need to buy certain kinds of products, and that there are more foods that are produced, and they are very clear about the fact that not only are there no nut products in the food, but there were no nut products in that factory, or things that a growing list of products that don't have gluten in them for people who have celiac disease, which is another kind of problem. So it seems as if manufacturers are actually really starting to pay attention to this issue.
Yes. One of the things that happened a couple of years ago is that the federal government passed a food allergy labeling law for the U.S., and that states that if the food that they're manufacturing has one of the eight major foods or food groups, which would be milk, egg, peanuts, wheat, soybeans, the fish as a group, the tree nuts, and the shellfish, that they have to label it with very plain language that says peanuts or says milk. It used to, they could label it with a scientific name and people didn't recognize that. So that helped initially. But then what happened, and so most of the major manufacturers really do a good job of labeling, but what happened then is that the second generation of labeling happened, likely for medical legal reasons, and that if a particular product was made in a plant that another line had peanuts in it, they labeled that product may contain. And so there are or a lot more foods labeled now may contain than we ever saw 3 years ago just because of the outgrowth of that particular law. And the federal government is trying to readdress that now to have it better in line about what we need to do. But then what's happened, as you suggest, is that there's another part of the industry that is responding to families that have allergic children and trying to manufacture foods that they can be very comfortable that there's no way that they're contaminated. And so that's the third kind of aspect of this process that's happened in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are significant numbers of people, adults particularly, that do have something beyond food intolerance but that really don't know it? Or is it really possible that you could have this and have a problem like this and really not be aware of it?
I think for an adult, if they're having the skin or the respiratory symptoms, that it's something that is fairly noticeable and generally they're going to recognize, at least they're having symptoms and try to begin to find out with their physician what it might be. I think that, as one of the callers suggested earlier, those that have recurrent but intermittent gastrointestinal symptoms, that area is often more difficult to try to identify what is causing the disease because there's so many different types of things from other from food allergy to other autoimmune diseases that occur in the GI tract to other reasons to have gastrointestinal disease, that's a much more difficult area to try to look at.
Yeah. And just as a way of wrapping up again, because we kind of wanted to make a major focus for children and parents, for parents who know that they have children who are having some problems here, and the question I'm sure that they always ask to you, for example, or to their doctors is this going to be a lifelong problem? It sounds like the answer is, well, that really depends on what it is that we're talking about and what the agent causing the allergic reaction is. In some cases, it might be a lifelong problem, but in some cases, if you hang on here for a few years, it may well go away.
Yes, that's true. I think going back over those for those that have milk and egg and wheat and soy allergy, those really are likely to be outgrown. For those that have peanut, tree nut, fish, and shellfish, they're less likely. Although if we look at peanuts as an example, we know that children, as I described earlier, that year-and-a-half-old child that has peanut allergy, 80% of them will outgrow that. I mean, will keep it, but 20% will outgrow it. So it's important to stay in contact with your primary care physician or other people that have helped diagnose the child to find out if they're in that 20% that might have outgrown it, and not just assume it's not going to be outgrown without further testing.
Yeah. And now that we are in the age of the Internet, there's a lot of information available. Are there particular places that you would suggest parents go to try to get more information on what these problems are and how they work and how they can best adjust their lifestyle so they can live with them?
I think a couple of websites for parents that have children with food allergy, by far the best website is from the Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network, and their website is foodallergy.org. And the leadership of that particular group have done a really good job of trying to find out the latest information and surrounding themselves with good advisors that help them put the right things on the Internet for families to read. We use it literally daily in the clinic to help the families understand that they're not alone and lots of other people have this food allergy and where you're likely to come in contact with the foods and how to help avoid it. So I think that's helpful. From the allergic disease, just in general, the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, which is 4As and then an I.org, that's an extremely helpful website that helps families that have allergic disease in general read about them and help understand how they may help their physician diagnose them.
All right. Dr. Wesley Birks, he is the professor and chief pediatric allergy and immunology at Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Birks, thank you.
David, it's nice been talking to you.